This is Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio, broadcasted on WFHB. We air every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. Stay tuned for some more.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Today we will be discussing an important topic around the world, coronavirus, or COVID-19. My name is Elise Lee, and today I am joined by Dr. Wayne Forrester, who is a professor of genetics at Indiana University and part of the Indiana University School of Medicine, Bloomington. Although Dr. Forrester is not a virologist, his knowledge of genetics and his opinions will give us some valuable insight into the new virus. So welcome, Dr. Forrester, to Hereabouts. Thank you for joining us. If you could just give us a short introduction to your life and what you've been doing here at IU.
Okay, well, first, thanks for having me. So I trained as a graduate student at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, quite a few years ago now, where I studied biochemistry. And while I was a graduate student, I became interested in genetics. So when I finished my PhD in Madison, I moved out to the University of California, Berkeley, where I joined a lab for 5 years that uses genetics in research. And so the project that I started there, which I continue in my lab here at IU, was to study certain aspects of development of the nervous system. And to do these studies, we use genetics and molecular genetics and genomic approaches in a small nematode called Caenorhabditis elegans. And so we've looked for mutations that affect the development of the nervous system and then studied those to figure out what the gene does. I've been at IU 21 years now. I've taught genetics almost since the beginning, and then I've taught a variety of other classes as well.
So what got you into genetics?
So when I was a graduate student, I was learning biochemical approaches to try and understand biological processes, and it's a very powerful approach, but the lab I was in interacted quite a bit with a few labs in Madison that studied genetic approaches or used genetic approaches to study aspects of animal development. And I became impressed and intrigued by the strength of using genetic approaches and what you could accomplish. So when I started thinking about what I was going to do when I finished up, I decided that I was going to use genetic approaches and look for a lab that was using genetic approaches. And I decided that I was going to focus on labs using this nematode Caenorhabditis elegans because it offers a number of experimental advantages that make it a good choice.
Cool. So then, to our listeners who are not aware, with the coronavirus and the updates that we are getting, Indiana University has actually shut down classes post-spring break for about 2 weeks, and we will be going to online classes. So Dr. Forrester, as a professor yourself, how do you think that this is going to affect your classes? Especially in the STEM field, I think it's a little more difficult considering labs and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so my class doesn't have a lab, so that for me, that's an advantage, and for my students, because that's more hands-on, and so that's going to be more challenging for those instructors to deal with. For my class, it's a lecture class that has a discussion associated with it. And so, to some extent, I think moving the class online presents some challenges, but I think overall it won't be too bad. I mean, I typically record my lectures, and so I've always posted recordings of the lectures so that students can go back and re-listen to any parts they maybe had forgotten or that weren't clear at the time. So I'm hoping that that will work out well for the students, that they'll be able to get the basic information from lecture. I also am hoping to be as available as possible in as interactive a way as possible. I mean, I currently hold office hours. Students come and ask questions, and I almost always end up at the whiteboard writing out, you know, working through problems, writing out how to solve problems and explaining how to think about things. And I'm not entirely sure how this is going to work out doing this online, but I'm hoping to keep as much of that as possible, possibly even setting up my computer with a little video camera to try and capture myself working like at the whiteboard or in some way so that I can still work through problems to show students maybe through Zoom how to approach problems. So I'm hoping that it won't be too difficult. I mean, it's still not ideal because you don't get the face-to-face one-on-one interactions that we would get otherwise. So that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, but I'm hoping that we can make it work out well.
Have you used Zoom before? I know that's like what IU is basically. I think a lot of universities around the country are using it.
Yeah, so Zoom, I have regular meetings with my counterparts who teach. I also teach a class in the medical school. And so we have regular meetings with my counterparts at other campuses across the state. Those are always conducted by Zoom, and it almost always works really well. So it's a very good quality format. Usually the audio and video are pretty good, so usually I think it works well. I've never hosted one of those meetings, so I'm going to have to figure out how to set that up. But, you know, the university just had tutorials yesterday and today, which I couldn't do because they were during other meetings in class, but they've posted recordings of those, so I'm hoping that viewing those recordings and using other resources, it won't be too hard to figure out.
Yeah. And do you think it was a good decision of IU to put classes online for this two-week period?
Yeah, I don't think that there was any alternative. I know some people are unhappy because some classes, like some of the phys ed classes, you know, how do you do that online, right? You really can't. So I don't know how those instructors are approaching coping with the next few weeks, if it's only the next few weeks, could be longer. But I think overall, they really didn't have a choice. I mean, the virus is spreading at an ever-increasing rate, and it's essential to try and reduce that or to restrict the spread as much as possible. As far as I know, all universities, or at least all major universities, are doing the same thing. Most of them are, beginning with whenever their spring break occurs, are going to an online model for at least a few weeks. Some of them have even said, you know, for the rest of the semester. So IU has gone with 2 weeks. Whether or not they extend that, we'll have to see. I don't think anyone will be surprised if they end up extending that some, because I don't see any reason to think that the viral spread is going to plateau in the U.S. anytime soon. And I also felt that the way they made the decision and the timing of the decision was good, because it was early this week. We had enough time to meet with our classes and to say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it. You know, the local schools, for example, sent a note last night saying classes are canceled today, and the week after spring break, so their spring break is next week just like ours, the week after spring break they're going online. So students had no time to prepare. Hopefully students brought their textbooks and things home. The school system was forced into that because apparently they had an exposure of a student to the virus, and so they didn't feel like they had a choice. But with IU's approach, we've had most of the week to prepare, and although it's going to be challenging, that's so much better than you know, having this sprung all of a sudden. So yeah, I think overall, I think the decision was handled in the best way possible.
So then going back to the spread of the virus, could you just give us like a basic rundown of what a virus is, and then how also COVID-19 is spreading so quickly?
Yeah, so like you said, I'm not a virologist, but I can give sort of basic information, which is sort of my level of understanding, which is, so viruses, it's really like a little molecular machine or a little molecular parasite. It's a collection of molecules, proteins, and nucleic acid that functions by infecting a cell, using the biochemical machinery of that cell to make new viruses, and then releasing those viruses to go on and infect other cells. So this virus is doing just that. If you inhale the virus, it binds to cells within the lung, for example, introduces its nucleic acid, which in the case of coronavirus is an RNA, which gets into the cell, makes the DNA copy that directs the production of gene products, which ultimately make new viral genomes, new viral particles, which then are released from the cell and spread to infect other cells. And then after a while of infection, the individual has built up enough of a population of virus that they can spread it. So when they cough or sneeze, they expel droplets that include viral particles, and those can then infect other people and repeat the process. And this is what's happening all over the world now.
And do you think that it's accurate? I mean, it is coming from the CDC, so obviously it's pretty accurate, but they're saying that the spread of corona is like not an if, but it's like a when.
You know, I think anytime there's a new virus that appears, there's a very short window where if you detect it, you can try to shut it down. But outside of that window, once that initial period of time has elapsed, then it's very difficult because there are so many people who are infected. And this virus now is in most states in the country, and it's in most countries across the world. So clearly it's out there, and it's going to continue spreading. Even if we try to shut down person-to-person communication of the virus, there's a period of time during which it's still going to be spreading. To limit the spread, you have to limit the contact between individuals, but that's not an easy thing to do. And so even countries where they've essentially shut down, like Italy, they've shut down almost everything in Italy, the virus is still spreading. Now, hopefully, it will start to taper off soon, but that's going to take a few weeks. I mean, in China, in the Wuhan area, they shut down, I don't remember, it's been 5 or 6 weeks now, and clearly that's been effective. The rate of transmission, according to the government numbers, has gone down dramatically, but it's taken several weeks, and the same thing is going to happen elsewhere. In many countries, we haven't shut down to the same extent that these other places have. So, yeah, it's going to continue spreading. I don't think there's any doubt.
Right. And then I think the only comparison to COVID-19 that I could think of that was kind of this, I wouldn't say mass hysteria, but panic within the public that you can definitely feel, was probably H1N1. So that was like the last widespread thing that I could think of where people were kind of freaking out. So that was like elementary school for me. So yeah. As someone who was like at the university at that time, do you see like the same level of panic, or are you feeling that it's definitely raised?
So I think it's definitely much higher now. I think the threat is higher now. I mean, H1N1, it's a flu, and although there were a lot of unknowns with the flu, and the earlier H1N1 strain was the 1918 pandemic flu, which is one of the worst pandemics that we've seen literally in centuries. I think that there was a lot of concern. There was a lot of measures put in place to try and limit the spread of the virus, but I don't think anything like what we're seeing now. At least I don't remember it being anything like this, and I don't remember the anxiety being the same. I mean, in some ways, it almost feels almost like 9/11, which obviously is a completely different situation, but there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of, you know, unknown. We don't really understand in some way. I mean, we understand the virus, but in some ways you don't really understand how it's going to spread and how people are going to react and how governments are going to respond. There was, I think, a lot of anxiety after 9/11. And I think there's, in some ways, there's a similar level of anxiety now. Although it's interesting, I was reading a story today that the extent to which people are feeling anxiety depends a little bit on their political affiliation. So conservatives are much less anxious than Democrats or liberals. And I think partly that reflects sources of information, what we're being told. But I mean, I think realistically there's a lot of reason to be concerned and to be taking this seriously and to be taking precautions. You know, I'm not saying you should lock yourself in a room for the next 6 months, but you know, there are things that we can do to try and limit the spread. And the concern is and should be high enough that we try to do as many of those things as possible.
So what do you think about people like rushing to buy face masks, toilet paper, hand sanitizer? There's a real panic going on. So that was interesting to see people do that.
Yeah, you know, some of that's predictable, and it happens after almost any disaster where people start thinking, I'm not going to be able to get this, and so I need to get it now and stockpile it. And then by doing that, of course, you create the shortage that you were fearing in the first place. You know, I mean, the recommendation is that you wash your hands frequently and that you use hand sanitizer. So, you know, if you don't have it, it makes sense to get it. The stores, at least for the moment, have run low on supplies of both of those things. The toilet paper one, I have to say, I don't quite understand as much. I mean, yes, it's an essential and you don't want to run out of it, but, you know, it's not directly involved in limiting the spread of virus. So, but it's interesting because I have relatives in Germany and they tell me that they're seeing the same thing. The grocery stores are pretty well stocked except for cleaning things like hand sanitizer, soap, and toilet paper. So it's not limited to us. It seems to be a pretty general phenomenon.
Interesting that you have family in Europe. I'm curious as to, have you heard, like, can you feel what they're feeling? Are they feeling, like, more panic than we are? How is the situation over there?
Yeah, so my relatives are in Germany. And in Germany, they're feeling, I think, similar to us. You know, Germany has, I think, a few more cases than, they have maybe as many, twice as many cases as us, but they're not in the situation that Italy is in, for example, where they have a vast number, some 15,000 or so cases as of today. And so I don't think there's the level of stress and anxiety and maybe panic that you see in places like Italy. I think there's a certain amount of anxiety. We're all a little bit concerned with what's going to come. It's all a little bit unknown, and that can be a little bit unnerving. But I think by and large, my sense from the emails that I've gotten from them, they're feeling about like we are.
So then, do you think that hospitals in our area are prepared to handle COVID-19?
Yeah, so that's a question that I'm not really in a position to answer. So the answer that I'll give you is based largely on what I've read in news reports, which say that there's reason for concern, let me put it that way. So we have sufficient hospital space to accommodate, you know, the normal illnesses and injuries that you get, including during a flu season, where often illnesses go up and flu can be a serious infection and can lead to hospitalization for some individuals. Adding this on top of that, it all depends on the rate at which the infections occur. If we can keep the rate slow so that you spread out the hospitalization, so that you don't have a crush of people who need hospitalization right away, then from what I've read, we'll be okay. If we don't do that, if we just let this thing spread like crazy, then no, we will exceed the capacity of the hospital. Apparently in Italy, right now, doctors, at least in some hospitals, are literally having to decide who to treat and who not to treat. And not treating for people who are seriously affected can mean that those people will pass away. So hopefully, you know, I feel like we've been slow to respond to the virus, but we're now beginning to take it seriously. And I'm hoping that means that we will begin to retard the rate of spread of the virus and that we will be okay. You see a lot of talk about flattening the curve, which nobody talked about 2 days ago. But if we can spread out those cases, then we don't exceed the capacity of hospitals to treat patients and everybody can get the appropriate treatment. So that's our hope.
And then is it true the reports about how COVID-19 is mainly affecting the older population versus the younger population?
Yeah, I don't know. So it depends on what you mean by affecting. So in terms of infecting, I'm assuming that young people can be infected as readily as older people. But in terms of affecting, in terms of how severe the disease is, it's clear that the elderly are, in general, being much more severely impacted. I mean, the numbers that I've seen recently say that the lethality rate for people over 80 is perhaps over 15%, which is a pretty staggering number. And yet the overall lethality, we don't have a really accurate estimate because we don't have a good estimate of the number of people who've been infected and really even a completely accurate estimate of people who have died from the virus. But the best guesses right now are that it's somewhere around 1% or perhaps even below 1%. And so overall, it's a serious disease. I mean, 1% is still, that's still a significant number. But 15% for people over 80, that's a frightening number.
Do you think we will begin to see the amount of COVID-19 cases decrease, or do you think it will continue to spread for a long period of time or like a shorter period of time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, I'd like to say that it's going to peter out soon, but I don't think anyone believes that. I think that if we limit person-to-person contact, we'll delay spread. And that has the one maybe undesirable effect of sort of dragging it out to some extent, but it keeps the rate of infection down enough that hospitals are able to treat people as they need treatment. And so from that standpoint, that's still the desirable goal. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the plots of the number of cases, it's still going up exponentially day after day, and I don't see any end to that anytime soon. Now, in some places, like in parts of China, it seems that the rate of infection has really come down dramatically, but that, again, that took several weeks of really locking down communities, and so I think it will be at least several weeks before we see viral infections plateauing. Projections that I've seen suggest that we may still be dealing with this at some level for several months, if not even a year from now. You know, the hope is that there are several hopes. One is the hope is that summer weather might damp down the spread of this virus. We don't really know whether that will be the case, but that's what typically happens with flu. And that ultimately we'll come up with either an antiviral that works against this virus, and there are some candidates that are being studied, or, you know, a year or so from now that we'll have an effective vaccine. Again, these are unknowns, but, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if that was the case. So I think in the short term, we're going to see the number of cases increasing continuously, hopefully with measures that are being implemented now and that I'm imagining will be continued to be implemented by more and more places in the country. Hopefully we'll see a plateau in the not too distant future, but that's going to be weeks, if not a few months.
I've seen also the numbers for China are going down too, and it seems that they're pretty good at containing what's going on. But I think that is largely due to the SARS outbreak that was in early 2000s. Do you think that China is more prepared for this because of SARS, or do you think that it's like the way that they're containing it, and how do you think that America can also implement what China is doing?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on the Chinese government's approach to epidemics, so I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question. I will say that it's always clear in any sort of epidemic that's spread person to person, the way you combat it is you limit that spread. And China has done that very effectively. Other countries are now doing the same thing. Italy is doing that. Unfortunately for Italy, they're still in the early stages of that. They only really locked down the country early this week. And so it will take a while before cases start to level off. But hopefully that will be the case. So I think there's good understanding that the way you limit the spread of infectious agents is you just cut off the ability of the agent to find new people to infect. And China has done that, and they've been effective, at least in some areas.
Right, the social distancing concept.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could we talk about like the strains and then like maybe like comparing it to the flu again, like what we were talking about earlier?
So one question you asked me earlier was, the flu comes back year after year, is the same thing going to happen here? And the answer is, and again, I am not a virologist, so to any virologists who may hear this, you know, hopefully I'm not completely off base, but my understanding of the flu is that the way the flu genome is constructed, it's composed of multiple bits. And those bits can be relatively readily recombined to generate, so to take bits from different flu particles and to produce a new flu strain that has different epitopes. So when you get sick, your body makes antibodies. Those antibodies recognize epitopes, which in the case of a virus are proteins on the surface of the virus, and that ultimately lets the body clear the virus. And so when flu genomes recombine, you get different versions of epitope produced. And so last year's vaccine doesn't work against this year's flu virus because it has different versions of the proteins on its surface, and so the antibody that you produced last year doesn't recognize this year. The coronavirus, as I understand it, doesn't work in the same way, and so I think the likelihood that we'll see year after year of coronavirus, I hope I'm right in saying this, I think that it's not likely that this will be a recurrent year after year event. I mean, SARS initially began to spread fairly vigorously. There was a lot of concern about SARS. It didn't seem, my understanding is that it wasn't spread as readily from person to person as the current virus is, but it's another coronavirus. It's another similar virus. And it was knocked out largely by just preventing the spread from person to person. And so it was largely contained or wiped out in that way. I don't think that coronavirus has the same capacity for recombining genomes to produce new variants as the flu virus does. So I'm hopeful that that won't be the case. There is always the possibility that you'll get a strain of virus that gets a mutation and that changes the epitope. But the problem with that from the perspective of the virus is that it needs those proteins to, so some of those proteins are involved in binding up in cell surface receptors that allow the virus to get into our cells in the first place. And so if it gets a mutation that now doesn't let the antibody bind to and inactivate the virus, that's also going to potentially affect the ability of the virus to even infect cells. So hopefully that we won't have the same issue with the coronavirus.
And it will take about a year for like a vaccine to be in the works, correct?
Yeah, so I think it will take several months to develop a candidate vaccine, and then you have to demonstrate that it's an effective vaccine, so you have to test it, and then you have to produce it at sufficient levels to immunize large numbers of individuals. And overall, that process is about 12 to 18 months.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Forrester, for all of the information and for meeting with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Good luck. Everybody stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. We air every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. on WFHB.